Go ahead and bring this meeting to order today. Good morning, it's Senate Finance, it's 9:15, we're running a little late tonight, today, 9:15 a.m., February 8th, 2008. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins is excused, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, and Senator Dyson was here, and I'm sure he'll be right back, he just stepped out. We're going to have three items on the agenda, but today we're going to start off with Senate Bill 119, Library Grants. We've had that bill up before. We're going to hear a new bill, Senate Bill 57, Marine Parks Additions. And then we're going to go on to House Bill 13, Pension Obligation Bonds. The Pension Obligation Bond bill, this will be an introductory review of the bill, and we'll be continuing to work on that as we go forward. But before we get going on the meeting today, I'd like to remind everybody that at home that we've got a web address here, ledgefinance.state.ak.us, that we have our documents online for all the committee meetings. So the public is advised to either go directly to this or Google us up, and they could have the same documents, most of the same documents that we have here at the table through our process. So we've been working with the House Finance Committee to try to synergize the two websites and streamline things to make it more user-friendly for the public and easier access for documents. And if you run into documents that are confusing or you need a little bit of help, please call your elected official's office in your district, and I'm sure they'll be more than glad to help you with that information. Before we get started, I'd like to remind everybody if they could please turn off their cell phones and Blackberries, because it interrupts with the recordings. Yesterday we had an informal open caucus, and there was quite a few rings going on, and it was disruptive, and it started clear at the top of the Senate and went down, so we couldn't start the execution too fast. But anyway, we'll go ahead and start today on Senate Bill 119, Library Grants. The intent here is to adopt the committee's substitute, hear an explanation of the changes, take additional public testimony, and then entertain a motion moving the bill unless we come up with some issues with it. We have a new Finance Committee substitute that I've requested, and if Senator Olson, if you could please move version M.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 119, which is / M as in Mike.
Okay, and I'll object for explanation, and I would go ahead and ask Mr. Darwin Peterson to come forward, and he'll walk us through the committee substitute. And if you could please identify yourself, Mr. Peterson, and who you work for or who you represent, and then speak to the amendment in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. The CS that you have before you, version M, has been rewritten, especially section one, from the version that the committee saw last time. In section one of the bill, which is the library construction and major expansion portion of the bill, the previous version had the Department of Education administering the grants, and that has been changed now to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The section, page one, subsection B, is the same, other than the fact that the Board of Education is no longer involved in adopting the regulations now that it's under a different department. The major expansion portion is also a change in this version. Before, it was just library construction. We added the word major so that we could define it, and it's defined on page two, the top of the page. It's major expansion has to be an expansion that is at least 30% of the existing square footage. So that's identified. Then on page 2, line 3, the eligibility requirements are outlined. These are a little different from before. The library has to be publicly owned and operated and has to be located in a community with a population of less than 10,000 persons. That stays the same. And then we also have local communities getting involved with a match of at least 20%, but they can provide more. Private donors would contribute the remaining, and the state is can contribute no more than 50%. So the state's capped at 50%, local communities have to provide at least 20%, and the private donors pick up the rest. The library collection grant program has changed a little bit. It's still capped at $3,000 per library per year, but in subsection C on page 2, which begins on line 24, we've changed that a little bit. Before, there was an over-under provision. If there was too much money appropriated, then the remaining was given out as an incentive grant to the library. If there was not enough money appropriated, then it was divided amongst all the eligible grantees on a pro rata basis. So we changed that to just say that if there is not enough money appropriated, then it goes to the highest ranking eligible grantee. So we don't piecemeal it, we just take care of as many as we can with the appropriation that's available. And if there is too much money appropriated, then the remaining goes back into the general fund and is eligible for reappropriation. The only other change, Mr. Chairman, is on page 3, lines 23 through 25. This was in response to Senator Elton's concern that some of the school districts may use this money to supplant their responsibility, and that's defined that's not, they're not able to do that. That the library collection grants may not be used to supplant school district expenditures for the library. So those are all the changes, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We have questions. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the event that there are more applicants and funds allowed, what is the criteria being used?
The criteria and how the applicants will be ranked will be developed by the department in their regulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at some of the issues here under 1456, 356, the eligibility publicly owned libraries, are we excluding then other than public schools and other than public libraries?
Through the chair, Senator Olson. This grant is for construction and major expansion of publicly owned libraries and communities. It's not for school libraries. So the school, that's why the title had to be changed to say grant programs to support libraries, because there's one portion of the bill that deals with collection grants for public schools and the other portion deals with construction grants for public libraries in small communities.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have other questions? Okay. I'll go ahead and remove my objection for the adoption of version M. Do we hear other objections? Seeing no objections, we'll go ahead and adopt version M as our working document. We'll go ahead and go to the testimony. We'll start with Judy Englund from Ketchikan. Ms. Englund, if you could identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Judith McQuarrie. Got married, changed the name. And I am so very happy that you have decided to support Senate Bill 19. Library, especially the library construction portion of it and the school library collection portion. My question is about why we have the population limit of 10,000 persons in a community. As you may know, Ketchikan is embarking on a construction program for a public library, and if we consider the community of Ketchikan, we don't qualify. If it's the municipality of Ketchikan, then we would qualify. Regardless, This is a wonderful step forward for the library community in the state of Alaska, and we are very grateful. Thank you.
My interpretation of that bill is the city of Ketchikan does qualify. The reason we put in a population limit is when we look at our major population centers, Anchorage, Fairbanks, I think the Eagle River area, and Juneau, they would take substantially larger sums of money. They would be an individual appropriation targeted to those libraries because they're just of their magnitude and size and scope. So it's, and then the smaller communities, which is virtually everyone else, would go through the process if the bill is adopted of applying and then being ranked by the department. And then the legislature would, if it so choose, if we were in a fiscal position to do so, would approve a block amount of funds for that, and it would go right down the list to the cutoff. The city of Ketchikan's at 7,622 is the number of residents we have. Juneau's at 30,000. So, you know, there's a magnitude difference in what we're looking at in scope. And in particularly when we look at Anchorage, where we house our large, there's large museums and large libraries and because of the concentration of people. Let's go ahead and go to Terrilly Alcock of Petersburg. If you could please introduce yourself and then speak to the bill, please.
My name is Tara Alcock, and I'm the director of the Petersburg Public Library, and I'd like to voice my support for Senate Bill 119. And I'd specifically like to address Section 1, the Library Construction Matching Grant Program. In rural Alaska, public libraries are critical community spaces, and the need for a new library in our community is urgent. Hundreds of Petersburg residents spoken out in favor of a new library for our community. And we're currently developing a plan for a library that we think meets our community's needs, is affordable and sustainable over the long term. I believe that financial support from the community is an essential component of any library project. And this library construction grant program, as proposed in Senate Bill 119, is an excellent strategy to match local support as well as leverage private donations for new library facilities in rural Alaskan communities. And I'd like to thank you all for your work on this bill and for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Okay, thank you. We'll go on now to Julie Hersey. Julie, if you could identify yourself, please, and speak to the bill.
Good morning, and thank you, Senator Stedman and Senator Olson, for this bill. SB 119 is a very positive step for libraries here in Alaska. I'm the president of the Petersburg Library Board, and we're working hard, as Tara said, to put plans together for a new library. I'm very happy to hear about your support for libraries and the idea that the state matching private donations and foundation grants really makes our dream attainable. The public library in Petersburg was built in 1959. I think Senator Stedman has been there since you were a little boy. The city's outgrown this leaky, overcrowded, and inadequate facility. It's not even ADA compliant anymore, if it ever was. The new library we're planning is about 7,500 square feet in the heart of downtown Petersburg. And we've been asking the community, you know, how they feel about it, and 86% of the people polled in 2007 believe we need a new library. Our present city council agrees, and our project is number 4 on the capital projects improvement list, right after the fire hall, and there are 2 other projects that are ahead of it are already in the budget. And we want to put a bond issue forward in October of 2008 that will ask voters if they would raise the $2.5 million that we need through a temporary sales tax. So we definitely believe our community should do its part towards raising money for a library, but the funding needs that could be met through a combination of state and local donations would make us reach our goal. And we already have $31,000 in our endowment fund. The Masons just generously donated $25,000 to our project, so we're working hard to get money together locally. With a budget surplus that tops anything in Alaska history, this seems like a good time to build resources for communities. and will carry them into the future. Thank you for your farsightedness and your vision. And with your help, we can turn Petersburg's dream of a new library into a reality. Thank you very much for your time and for your support of libraries.
Thank you. And we'll go on to the last person on the list here, Melinda Hofstead from Petersburg. Melinda, if you can identify yourself, please, and who you represent and speak to the bill.
Yes, good morning, Senator Stedman. My name is Melinda Hofstead, and I am representing myself, although I am a member of the Petersburg City Council. And I just wanted to come in this morning and speak very positively on behalf of Senate Bill 119, and let you know that the council has just recently met and put forward our CIP list, and that the library is one of our top priorities. I wanted to commend our, we have a very diverse local group who has been working diligently for, I believe, the last 4 or 5 years on trying to get a new library here. Our library is very small. The roof is leaking, and we're in danger of losing our collection, our library collection. We have, you heard from Tara, who is our librarian, who I'm going to just brag her up. I think she's the best librarian I've ever seen. She's creative. She's doing absolutely wonderful things with our young people here and bringing wonderful programs, but I think she's maxed out our facility to the limit. She's using city council chambers, the hallways, and every possible place she can in our building. Last year, our library had 54,000 visits, and that's pretty astounding for a town the size of Petersburg, but we need a new building. And I'm an avid library user, and as a user, I'm really thrilled with this bill because as I've examined our finances of the city, I know that it can't just be done with city money, although the council is very enthusiastic about the city doing its part, and they're embarking here on a really local drive for private contributions, and the private sector has been very generous so far, and I believe will continue to. We've got the 4-Acre Foundation working on coming up with a plan that is affordable, sustainable, and cost efficient. So we're really working hard here for our new library to be fiscally responsible, but this bill could make it happen. And so I just want to encourage you to push hard for it, and we support it here.
Thank you, Councilman Hofstead. Do we have any, that's the end of the online people. Do we have any initial comments here or questions here at the committee? And then we're going to go to the audience here. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could probably wait till others comment, because but there was the question was raised about the community, what constitutes a community. So I think that's not necessarily an issue, but I think it should be, you know, defined a little bit better just to make sure that we know what it is. I wouldn't hold up a bill based on that, but I think that is, and maybe that is part of the regulation or something where they take care of that. But I think that, you know, just to stop arguments in the future as to what that may be, and I suppose in the regulations as well, there will be some addressing of the issue of the ongoing maintenance of the facilities that the matching grant would go into, to make sure that the people have thought through that as far as how they would continue to sustain and operate that particular library. So just comments, I guess, not necessarily questions.
Well, we're going to, I'll have Mr. Peterson here speak to the definition of community. But the issue of ongoing maintenance and replacement reserves is an issue. What we don't want to do is build these structures around the state, no matter if it's a road or a building, and then have a maintenance issue, and much like we had in the harbors, 20 years later they're falling down, and you know, and then we have a mess. So in the regulations that will be drafted, the department will go ahead and draft regulations identifying the need to have those in place, and for the communities to show they have the fiscal capability to address those issues and fund it. So when we as a state allocate some financial help to construct, in this case, a library, We don't have to worry about the library coming back because their roof's leaking or they're, you know, they're out of compliance. It should be an up and running going concern. So that is why the bill is moving forward with no funding in it. We need, this is just the first step. The second one is to get the regulations written.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, would you please identify yourself again for the record and then speak to the community definition, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. Senator Thomas, through the chair, I did bring up that question and that concern with the drafter at Legislative Legal. She said that the term is used throughout statutes and it's an all-encompassing term, so it includes towns, cities, even boroughs. So any community that is a town, a city, a borough that has a population of 10,000 or less would be included. So we can define that term using that definition. We can specify that it includes a town, a city, a borough, any location where people gather, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Senator Thomas.
Would it be, thank you, Mr. Chairman, would it be as loose as to be considered that a community could be not necessarily an organized area, but could just be a area that has existed for a long time and people have considered it a community and they've, maybe even have set up their own little facilities of some type, although they're not actually organized under as organized as defined by the state of Alaska.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yeah, they don't have to be in organized Alaska. It can be anywhere in the state, but at the provision that we have inserted in this CS where the community has to provide at least 20% matching grants, I think would eliminate the concern of some of the smaller areas where just a few people are gathered and maybe have small facilities. They wouldn't have the financial ability to contribute 20% to the construction of a new library.
Senator Dreisen.
Yeah. Same question when it comes to a community that's organized under federal law.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, yeah, for example, the community of Metlakatla.
Yes, sir.
They would qualify, yes, sir.
And others that are on the list of tribes or villages?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, as long as it's, if it were a town that is considered a community in Alaska statutes, even if they were considered a tribe by the federal government but not recognized as a tribe by Alaska, they would still qualify if they are, if they're a community, any gathering of people live together.
Yeah. My follow-up question is, if they're not organized under state law but are recognized in some venue under federal law, they would still qualify.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, if they're not recognized as a community under state law, they would not qualify. But I can't think of an example of any areas in the state that are recognized by federal law as a community but not by state law. I can't think of an example of one.
All right. I can, but thank you.
Okay.
I can address that with the drafter, through the chair, Senator Dyson, if you'd like. Get back to you on that.
Okay.
I have other questions from the committee members. Do we have anybody from the audience like to come forward and speak on the bill today? I see quite a few people here, but I think they're here for other items. And we have no other questions, any other concerns? Motion, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate.
Excuse me, let's have Senator Olson do the motion. It's said bill.
And that is Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Chairman.
Okay, we'll go back on the record, please. Okay. Go, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we pass out CS for Senate Bill 119 with accompanying recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes onto the next committee.
Hearing no objection, we'll go ahead and move this, and I'd like the record to reflect we do have a zero fiscal note. That'll come at potentially some future date. Okay, we're going to go on to the next item on the agenda, Senate Bill 57, marine park additions. And we'll have a presentation here shortly from Senator Elton, who's a sponsor of this, and the intent is to go ahead and move this bill unless we find an area of concern or some issue comes up, and then we'll deal with that accordingly. But Senator Elton, if you would like to go to the head of the table and present the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kim Elton, Senator from District B, and the sponsor of SB 57. The bill in front of the committee is relatively simple. I'm not going to read the sponsor statement, but I will highlight a few things for the committee. The bill adds 14 islands, some of them probably more appropriately called islets, that are adjacent to Juneau and adjacent to the existing marine parks system. They range from Lincoln Island, north of Juneau, to Portland Island, which is the southern most boundary and is just outside of Auk Bay in Favorite Channel. The islands are frequented by locals and Southeast Alaska residents. They use the islands for many purposes: deer hunting, fishing, gathering of subsistence food, recreation activities, picnicking and camping. And the islands are an integral part of the community's tourism economy also. They're adjacent to all of the sightseeing boats that you see coming out of Auk Bay in the summertime. The sightseeing boats take a large number of tourists on whale watching excursions, marine mammal sightings, bird life on the islands. By adding the islands, the state's going to make possible the opportunity for local outdoor groups, and I'm speaking mainly here of territorial sportsmen, although there are other outdoor groups who work with the Division of Parks and the Department of Natural Resources, to add amenities to the park system, including cabins, outhouses, picnic areas and shelters, boat ramps that make it easier for the public to enjoy the islands. The bill was developed in consultation with the Division of Parks, Juneau Parks and Recreation Advisory Committee, the Juneau State Parks Advisory Committee, local tourism companies, the City Borough of Juneau. It excludes private land holdings and protects the private land holdings in some of the area. Also would like to point out that the bill is supported by the City and Borough of Juneau. They've passed a resolution in support of it. Territorial Sportsmen, which is one of our largest outdoor recreation and hunting groups. Gold Belt Native Corporation, which is intimately involved in the business community, including mining and tourism. Anytime Charters, the Juneau State Parks Advisory Board, Southeast Alaska Land Trust, Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. I just point out this is probably one of the few things where you'll see the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council supporting having their name in conjunction with Gold Belt Native Corporation. It demonstrates the wide support for the bill. Behind me in the audience, Mr. Chair, we have a representative of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation if there are questions that the committee might have. The only other thing that I would add, Mr. Chair, is that in the previous committee, partly at your suggestion, we added a 10-fathom line so that we could protect an area adjacent to the marine parks for use for buoys, for boats that may want to access the beaches and the parks. And the other thing the bill does that I think is very important is it provides that in none of the marine park system can the commissioner prohibit hunting and fishing. So we're protecting those traditional uses of these areas. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll try and answer any questions. If they get too detailed, I might suggest that we have the representative from DNR come up.
Okay. Do we have any initial questions for the sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that hunting's available to go ahead and be allowed on these islands. What about things like trapping?
Yep.
Is there a restriction on trapping?
Yes. If you take a look at Section 2, it provides the commissioner may not prohibit fishing, hunting, or trapping within a marine park unit.
Mr. Chairman, one final question. Does that include commercial fishing?
Yes.
It does. Thank you.
I'd like to just note that in the earlier committee, there was a discussion on how far offshore the park should go, and the discussion took place, and it was decided that 10 fathoms is easily identified on the charts because of the color differentiation. And there's normally 10-fathom lines on all of the electronic charts, so it's easy for citizens to know when they're in and when they're out of the park. If we have no other questions, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many acres are we talking about here?
I don't know. Through the chair, I don't know Senator Hoffman, but somebody from the division probably does. I would note that some of these islands that are listed are very small.
And maybe we'll ask Mr. Mike Eberhardt, hiding out back there in the room. He can come forward. You can identify yourself and who you represent, and then maybe you could help us with a few of the technical points on the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mike Eberhardt. I'm the Southeast Area Park Superintendent for the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. And if I could get you to repeat the question for me, that would be great.
There was an interest in knowing how many acres are included in this bill when you add up the islands and the parts of Shelter Island?
I don't currently have the total acreage in front of me. I know we have calculated the water acreage and the land acreage, and I'd have to stretch my recollection, but there's approximately, I think, 1,500 acres of land. I know it was just under 2,000 acres because we had reduced some. So I believe that's a fairly accurate number. I thought it had been in the packet, but.
And maybe you can bring that back to the committee sometime just so the members know what and break it down by water versus land.
And it is calculated. Broken down that way.
Yeah, Senator Elton.
Yeah, and thanks, Mr. Chair. I've gotten the nod from a person who's going to be testifying. They do have that number for us.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson.
One other question that I have is, as you look at the land here, is there or how much of it is private lands that are included?
There's currently only, I think, three small private inholdings within the park, and we have talked with all of the landowners, and there's very small private parcels that are left over from when the land was transferred to the state. They were federal home sites. So they're fairly isolated, remote from any of the public use areas.
Are they going to be, Mr. Chairman, are they going to be testifying, or do we have a letter of support? Are they in support of this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we have talked with them. We don't have letters of support from them, but they have not voiced any opposition when we've gone to them or come to us in any way, so we don't.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On the definition of inholding that you're using, I assume that these three parcels you're referring to have waterfront access? Within the center part of the island?
No, Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
I think we have Senator Elton and Senator Dyson.
Just to note that we do have a letter from one of the inholders in the packet, and that letter is supportive. I don't know that the other two have, but they have not opposed the additions that we're talking about here.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. And thanks to Senator Olson for raising this issue. am I correct in assuming that the private property rights of those inholders are not diminished by what we're doing here, so that their access or ability to build on those sites are is not diminished?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
It is a sensitive subject in Alaska, inholdings. We have any other questions for the Parks Superintendent? If you, Mr. Eberhard, if you could just stay there just in case we have a question, and then we'll have Gary Miller come forward. And Mr. Miller, if you can identify yourself and who you represent, and then follow that in with the acreage.
Yes, my name is Gary Miller. I'm a member of the Juneau State Parks Advisory Board. I don't have as an acreage as I have in square miles. It would be 12.1 square miles of land that would get added in. And for the water, based on the previous version of the bill, it was 11.5 square miles. That would be reduced with the 10-fathom boundary. And to give you a feeling what 12.1 square miles would be, from here to Bartlett Hospital is 3.5 miles. So that would be half of a, or one side of a square. So that'll give you a feeling for how much land that is. Other than that, the previous people have covered pretty much all the points that I was going to make.
And most of it's on Shelter Island and Lincoln Island?
Most are Shelter and Lincoln, right. Lincoln is really important to me because I deer hunt there. Most of the people on our board are deer hunters, so we're real keen on keeping that open to hunting. And I understand Lincoln is trapped, but from the times I've been over there, they either aren't very good trappers for the beaver or something, but there are lots of beaver on that island. Makes me wish I was a trapper.
Do we have any other questions? We don't have anybody online to speak to this issue, and do we have any other buddy from the audience that wants to come forward and speak? We have any questions? This is the first time this bill has been heard here at the table, so if there's any questions or concerns, okay, seeing none, then I'll ask Senator Elton for a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 57, I think it's version L, with the attached fiscal notes.
Individual recommendations?
And individual recommendations.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee, Senate Bill 57. Do we hear objection? Okay. Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move this bill on to the next committee referral. And we're going to take a brief at ease while we fire up the cameras for the next presentation. come back on the record. Up for the first time is House Bill 13, Pension Obligation Bonds. Today we're going to go through a general overview from the bill sponsor and from the administration, and then we're going to set the bill aside. We're going to bring it up and work on it intermittently. This is one of the integral parts in dealing with the cornerstone of the fiscal framework we're working on. So you'll see this bill back a couple of times. It has immense magnitude in dollars, as you'll see as we move through this. The plan is to go ahead and have a look at the bonded indebtedness of the state in the framework of the fiscal structure, along with the pension liability of $8 to $10 billion that the state faces. And this would be one of the tools that could be implemented into helping us facilitate the cash flow needs to fund that unfunded liability. So it's, again, a piece of a puzzle. But with the documents that everybody has on the table, there's one book here, Pension Obligation Bonds and Other Post-Retirement Benefits, a third edition by Orrick, or actually by Davis, I guess, Roger Davis. Everybody's got a nice, tight new binder. Hopefully, at the end, we'll have all the binders broken, where all the committee members have read this book, and I'll stop short of asking them to be sent back to the chairman for review. And then we've got, by the Department of Revenue, we've got the presentation today, pension obligation bonds, and then a document from the Pew Center on the States was put in by my office for the members to go ahead and review, along with some handouts on the position of other states around the country. So there's some documents there. And then from the Standard & Poor's rating digest, the time might be ripe for a pension obligation bond revival document. Now, my understanding is Standard & Poor's, a couple of their firm representatives are going to be here over the next week or so on some other matters, and we'll entertain a discussion with them on this issue also. I don't know if we're going to actually have that discussion, you know, in the committee format. We'll have to wait and see what their schedule is. But while they're here, we want to have a dialogue with that, and we're going to go ahead and start the presentation here as soon as Senator Dyson is ready. And if you could please, when you start, maybe go ahead and Representative Hawker, maybe I guess a better procedure would be for you to go ahead and introduce yourself and then kind of walk through the bill, and then we'll turn it over to the administration to walk through their presentation. We'll have some questions. Now, we're not planning on taking testimony today, and I know there's interested parties online, but testimony today will not be taken from the industry concerning this issue. That's going to come at probably the next meeting when we bring this back after the committee's been introduced to it and it has had some time to read through some of the documentation. And we'll bring it back at least one more time in whole, but we'll probably be bringing it back a couple of times in concept and in bits and pieces as we look at the cash flow and a few other things. With that, Representative Hawker, if you could please introduce yourself and who you represent and present the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Representative Mike Hawker. I represent District 32. It's a pleasure to be before the Senate Finance Committee. I'm presenting this bill today jointly with Mr. Brian Andrews, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue Treasury Division. If it serves the committee's pleasure, sir, I would like to give a fairly brief introduction and then let Mr. Andrews present a technical explanation of this financial device, and would certainly be very, you know, pleased to entertain questions from any one of your members at any time, sir. The bill before you, House Bill 13, has a lot of words in it. You know, I don't know how many pages it is, but it's got quite a few words. I am not going to try to talk at this moment about the detail within the bill, because I think it's important to talk about what it does first. And The what it does is really quite simple. Without having to replow too much ground here, certainly everyone in the legislature is very aware of our unfunded liability related to our pension retirement systems, both for the public employees and for the teachers' retirement system. That unfunded liability, which is the result of having insufficient assets in those pension trusts at the moment to, under a projected basis, to earn enough money to be sufficient to cover the liabilities that exist today. So we have a debt. We have the pension funds have a debt, a deficiency. That deficiency is what we call the unfunded liability. That liability, some of the most recent calculations have that pegged at about $8.5 billion for a combination of both the pension, the public employees, and the teachers' retirement system. And again, stating it more for the public record than certainly the members of this committee are very well aware, that our pension obligation, our retirement obligation to the state's employees is fixed in our Constitution. And the obligation to the retirement trust is really a contractual obligation of the state. It's not something that we can make a policy call and make it go away. We, as the legislative body of the state of Alaska, must ultimately pay these liabilities. And the bill before us presents a mechanism by which I believe, and I believe the evidence will strongly prove, that we as legislators can pay off that $8 billion liability at a substantial, or we can substantially minimize the amount that it will take to pay off that liability through the use of the capital markets, financial leverage. Very much, I tend to ask folks to think in the terms of the liability we have to our pension system is very much like a house, your house mortgage. You owe money on your house. The longer the debt goes unpaid or the more that you owe, it accrues interest because, again, that's obviously there's a cost to that capital. In our case, with our pension liabilities, we also accrue the equivalent of interest on those liabilities. And that's because by not having those funds invested in the pension plans, they are not out there invested and earning interest. So, you know, we into the future are always going to have to be making up that interest. The device that is being offered to you today in this bill is what is referred to as a pension obligation bond authority, or the ability of the state and political subdivisions of the state. This bill would empower those political subdivisions to do what's the equivalent of refinancing your mortgage at a lower rate. Where we're losing the investment opportunity in our pension funds, it is possible for us to go into the international capital markets, borrow money at a very low rate of interest. And again, the technical details, Mr. Andrews would be happy to provide you, but we're essentially borrowing low, investing it in our pension retirement funds, where this state has a stellar track record over time of realizing interest earnings, investment earnings, much greater than the cost of that capital. The state saves on the arbitrage, which is the difference between the rate you borrow and the rate you earn when you invest. To emphasize that financial professionals, legislators, should always be cautious when we talk about arbitraging funds because there are many federal restrictions on arbitrage. However, in this case, the transactions contemplated are specifically sanctioned by the Internal Revenue Service, the federal authorities. This is a very proven, well-established tool that has been used in many jurisdictions, much to their advantage. I know, Mr. Chairman, you will have or avail yourself of the opportunity to speak to some of the folks that have experienced direct experience in those other jurisdictions. Would like to particularly emphasize that the bill before you is an empowerment bill. It empowers municipalities, the bond bank, Alaska Housing Finance Authority, and the state of Alaska to engage in these sorts of transactions. I think it's a very comprehensive bill, a very comprehensive empowerment, but it does not either authorize or lead us necessarily into conducting a transaction. Again, very much like the bill you just had before you, where we create a library grant fund, but until we choose to avail ourselves of that, it's authority, but it will require further action before you actually execute any such transaction. In this case, I know we're all very concerned about transactions being executed responsibly. We're talking very large amounts of money here. And Mr. Andrews will discuss more of the both the risks and the controls inherent in the process. But again, I think, Mr. Chairman, you'll find that the markets themselves will be very much governing. It's very difficult for the state to get itself into a bad transaction because, again, all of the underwriters, the bond insurers, the financial capital market participants themselves, no one wants to see a transaction fail. And with all those eyes, we would be truly bringing the best and the brightest folks in both Wall Street and the best and the brightest folks we have in the state of Alaska. Those folks being the Mr. Andrews and his people working in the Department of Treasury, which I can only commend. We can look at their ability to perform based on a stellar track record over literally the past 20, 25 years of their management of our existing pension funds. The investment returns, the responsible management is just inarguable, and we as a state are really privileged to have such qualified financial managers on board. So as we go forward, sir, you did mention the ORIC book. This book written by Mr. Roger Davis, and I would commend it to the committee, as I know of no publication in America that is more succinct and more clear and easy to understand than this particular document on this subject. While it talks about the nature of these transactions, the appendixes also point out three particular state cases where they have been utilized. So with that, sir, if it serves the committee's pleasure, serves the chairman's pleasure, I'd be pleased to turn the presentation over to Mr. Andrews for a bit more of a technical analysis of what's being proposed.
Okay, if we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor before we have the presentation. Hey, Mr. Andrews, if you could go ahead and identify yourself and who's next to you, and or maybe she can identify herself for the record, and then go ahead and present your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Andrews. I'm a deputy commissioner in the Department of Revenue, in charge of the Treasury. On my left is Jay Shao. Jay is a special assistant in the commissioner's office and was an integral part of this presentation. She did a lot of the numbers crunching behind it and putting it together. This morning I'd like to share with you a general discussion about pension obligation bonds, or POBs, or POBs, and the presentation will take about 25-30 minutes. We'll start off with a quick overview. We'll talk about some of the reasons why we should consider POBs, what the risks are associated with POBs, and we'll talk about the potential savings that we can achieve with pension obligation bonds. And finally, we'll talk about why POBs are issued as taxable bonds as opposed to tax-exempt bonds. The actual mechanics of a POB transaction are relatively simple. In its simplest form, it replaces one form of debt that the state has with another form of debt which carries a lower interest rate cost. You can liken it, as Representative Hocker pointed out, to a refinancing of your mortgage on your house at a lower interest rate cost. For POBs to generate savings for the state, the investment return from the proceeds of the POB must exceed the interest cost of the bonds. The greater the investment arbitrage or the spread between the two rates, the better off the state will be in achieving a lower contribution rate to the state's pension plans. POBs have been increasingly popular and successful, a way that state and local governments have use these to accomplish their financial goals. And in fact, since 1995, six states and over 234 local governments have issued POBs totaling in excess of $40 billion. But a lot of people don't know that in the mid-90s, the city of Anchorage actually issued a POB to help them out with their retirement plan in Anchorage. Here's a quick chart of the United States, and you'll see that California and Illinois have been big issuers of POBs. Illinois holds the record for the largest POB. In the summer of 2003, they actually issued a POB of $10 billion. With me today, I have Debbie Snobble, who is with Scott Ballas. She's also the state's financial advisor on our debt obligations for the state. So at your pleasure, after my discussion, Mr. Chairman, you may want to bring her up now or in a later meeting, and she can describe that Illinois transaction to you. One other thing to note is that the state of Connecticut will probably issue a $2 billion POB transaction in the next 2 to 3 weeks, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops and how the market accepts that transaction.
Well, Mr. Enders, then you can report back to the committee on that process?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Why should we consider issuing POBs? Well, there's an interest rate savings, there's an arbitrage or a positive investment return potential, and the third reason is that POBs are not generally viewed, if structured correctly, by the rating agencies as being a detriment to a state's credit rating. So the best way to put that is that the rating agencies look at that, again, if structured properly, as a neutral situation, because the state already has the debt. All we're doing is simply replacing the debt with a cheaper form. But let me quickly point out that POBs are not a golden bullet. They're simply a financial tool to deal with the unfunded liability problem that we have with our pension plans. When we talk about this unfunded liability, or what we call the unfunded actuarially accrued liability, I just like to call it the unfunded liability, what we're really talking about is a bill that the pension systems are giving to state and local governments. That unfunded liability totals $8.6 billion at the last actuarial report that we have, which was for the summer of 2006. That $8.6 billion breaks that down to $5.5 billion for PERS and $3.1 billion for TERS.
Will you please define TERS and PERS for the people at home?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. PERS is Public Employees Retirement System, and TERS is the Teachers Retirement System.
Thank you.
Now, the state has two ways of paying off that bill. One way is paying it off with cash. So if we had $8.6 billion in the bank, we could simply turn that over to the pension programs, and we would have fully funded that unfunded liability. The second way that the state can pay that unfunded liability off is it can pay it off over time, over a 25-year period of time, but it carries with it a cost of 8.25%. Now, the real question is, can we, through a POB transaction, reduce that payment's cost to something less than the 8.25%? Real quickly, if we examine the bill in more detail, you'll see, like for PERS, as of, again, June 30th, 2006, from the actuarial report, the total liability of that was $14.5 billion. We have put away $9 billion of assets, but we're still short that $5.4 billion, which represents that we've got an underfunded, or we've only funded that liability at about 65%. The second reason we want to consider a POB transaction is for an interest rate savings. And again, that's the difference between the 8.25% and what we could issue a POB transaction for. The other day, Friday, we priced a $2 billion POB transaction out in the market just to see what kind of rate it would go out at. And if we were to issue a bond transaction this week, it would probably be at 5.25%. But let me also caution you that the credit markets right now are in a volatile state. There's a lot of uncertainty out there, so that, you know, next week if we were to look to do this, maybe the rate would be higher, maybe it's lower. But just wanted to say that the 5.25% is not firm by any means. Now, the difference between 8.25% and 5.25% over 25 years, or that 3% difference over 25 years, represents a savings of $323 million on $1 billion, or $23 million annually. Significant numbers. You'll see that right now we're in a very low interest rate environment. It's the lowest we've seen since the mid-60s. And in fact, on February 1, we saw 10-year treasuries in the 365 level. I think this morning they were up a little bit in the 370 level. But again, very, very low interest rate environment that we're currently in. In fact, the 10-year treasury has only been lower in the last 20 years, 3% of the time. So again, we're in a very favorable interest rate environment to look at a POB transaction. Last spring, when we were looking at this legislation over on the House side, there was actually a very short period of time last August where the transaction wouldn't have been feasible to do. But with the subprime market problems that have been created this fall, interest rates have come back down again, and again are a very favorable situation. Another reason of looking at a POB transaction is the earnings arbitrage. And if you look at this chart here, you'll see that for the last 16 years, the fiscal year returns on the public employees retirement system, on average, we've earned 9.67% over the last 16 years. And you'll see that the returns have ranged from a negative 5.4% in 2002, that was during the bear market of 2000, to a high of 18.8%, 18.9% last year. You can see that the numbers for 2003 on up are been very attractive numbers in difficult markets through the stewardship of our chief investment officer, who has done an excellent job. So, good numbers on average, but whenever you look at a return, you also have to look at risk and how much risk did we take in getting that 9.6%. And you'll see that risk is usually measured by volatility, and that's a measurement of standard deviation that the chair is very familiar with. And you'll see that we had a low level of volatility to those returns. TERS, very similar numbers because the asset allocation, the investment profile, that portfolio is very similar to PERS. And then very quickly, here's a chart of the asset allocations that we have in our PERS and TERS programs. This asset allocation is looked at each year by the ARM board and set by the ARM board with the help of our financial advisor, Callan. And you can see that going forward, the median return that we expect is 8% with a standard deviation of 12%. And what that really means is that two-thirds of the time we would expect the returns from the portfolios to be as low as a negative 4 to as high as 20%. And the third reason, or final reason, we should consider POBs is the credit neutrality that they have from the state's rating agencies. And you can see some comments from Moody's and Standard & Poor's that basically what they're saying is, we already recognize that you have this unfunded liability, and if you're trying to get it at a cheaper cost or reduce it, it shouldn't impact your credit rating in a negative fashion. Also, let me discuss for a minute that the rating agencies like to talk about the unfunded liability as being a soft liability. In other words, when you go to pay that liability, you can set back and do different, because it's a soft liability, you can ignore it for 1 year, catch up with another year. And you have some flexibility with it. When you do a POB transaction, you have turned that soft liability into a hard liability. In other words, every year you must make the payment on that bond. I would argue that our liability, that unfunded liability, is really a hard liability because it's set in Constitution. You know, constitutionally we guarantee the benefits of the participants of the pension systems. And in fact, the state, in challenging that a couple years ago in State versus Duncan, we actually lost. In other words, that liability is truly a hard liability for us. It's not like the state of Texas that doesn't have a constitutional provision, and they may or may not recognize those pension benefits that are out there. I would also argue, too, that setting up a POB and setting up that transaction or that liability as a hard liability actually brings some physical stability to the process, and where you look at making that payment out forward for the next 25 years. In this graph here, you will see that a prudent funding level for that unfunded liability that the rating agencies like to look at is around 80%. They don't like to see it go much above that, and the reason being is that if we overfund the pension plans, there's that political risk of then handing out more benefits, which may get us in trouble even further down the road. So usually when you look at that unfunded liability and you do a POB transaction, you like to bring it up to that fully that 80% funded level. Now, what are the risks associated with POBs? And the risks break down into investment risk, political risk, and market risk. Investment risk is fairly simple. If we issue a pension obligation bond at 5.25%, that's our cost. And we need to earn more than that 5.25% to make the POB attractive. If we earn less than 5.25%, then obviously we can't cover the cost of the bond. And that's as simple as that. What I did in this graph is go back, and we had already talked about the returns that the PERS plan has achieved since 1992, and you can see that in that first column. Then what I did is I put a column out there and said, okay, if we had done a POB that year, what would have been the cost of that POB? And then in the third column over, you can see what the cumulative results are. So for example, in 1992, if we had done a POB, we probably could have issued one at 7.75%. But over the last 16 years, we would have not only paid for the cost of the POB, but we would have had an increase of 79% return on that particular transaction. Now, is that the case every year? No. And this is one of the risks. If we had done a POB transaction in 2000, you'll see that we would still be clawing our way out of the hole, and that we'd actually be behind the cost of the POB by 8.21%. 2001 is the same scenario. We would still be clawing our way out of the hole. Now, if I'd showed you this chart last spring, you would have seen that also 2002 would have also been a negative number. But with the positive returns that we had for the fiscal year last year, we actually came back into a positive scenario there. This also highlights, again, one of the risks of, you know, when you do a POB transaction, if the markets go against you and you don't earn the cost of the bond, there may be a negative scenario for a period of time early on. And you really never know how the transaction will work out until it's finally paid out 25 years or the life of the bond.
Mr. Andrews, when
I guess maybe the, maybe it's coming, maybe it's not, but in your presentation here, but if it's not, the next go-around, could you bring forth some more analysis on this in more detail as far as the cash flow impacts? I think we all recognize the 90s were a decade. I want to stop right short of calling them an anomaly, but there were very strong equity market returns in the 90s, and there is some concern that that type of a decade might be a while before we see it again. And clearly we have the 02 and 01 numbers that are negative, and I think we will want to take a particular look at, you know, what happens in that type of environment. Because on the positive environment, it won't even be an issue at the table. But if, you know, we do hit those type of times, and so we'll want to take a good look at the cash flow for the payment structure.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we'll have that. And again, just to reemphasize your comments, this period of time included both a bull market in the 90s, the later part of the 90s, and then also the bear market of 2000, which was the most severe bear market that we've experienced since 1929, or the Depression. So it gives you a pretty good idea of both what can happen in a very strong market as well as a very weak market. But we'll put the cash flow analysis with it, you bet. Then just to recap, again, just to... There you go. As long as we make more than 5.25% on our investments, we're better off doing the POB transaction. And if we learn less than 5.25%, POBs would be undesirable. Now, the reason I put this in relationship to our unfunded liability, remember the part of the unfunded liability that we haven't paid off substituted with POBs still carries with it that 8.25%. And even going forward, as the plan has unfunded or, you know, liabilities going forward, we still have to achieve that 8.25% to keep the unfunded liability from growing, that we haven't used POBs to replace the old liability with.
Senator Thomas, you had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief one here on your two charts on 18 and 19. I was curious why you changed the estimated cost of borrowing column, because we would issue bonds at a certain amount, and that would be what they were. I was just curious why you had that amount fluctuate. I realize it's because that's what it could have been done in each of those years, but
correct.
But it probably would have been more instructive to me to see that it was carried through at the one specific amount that the bond would have been issued at, because your other amounts, I'm assuming, are actuals compared to that. Is that correct, or am I missing something?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, each year stands by itself. In other words, if we'd done a POB in 92 at 3.75%, at the end of 16, at the end of 2007, we would have had a positive cumulative return of 79.24. If we had done it in 93, that positive return would be almost 100%, or 96.98 there. If we'd done it in 94, the effect would have been 70% cumulative.
Are we looking at before or after transaction cost returns in?
These are after transaction costs. I mean, they the transaction costs of the are all included in that rate there.
So these are on the PERS. I'm looking at, yeah, you got PERS on the screen. Because I don't have the table in front of me, but those are net of transaction fees.
Yes. Yeah. So that rate includes the transaction fees. Very simple. In 2007, if we were to do a transaction last year, that rate would have been around 5.75, which would have included all costs. And you'll see that if we had done this transaction last year, we would have already been ahead of the curve by 13%.
guess we're going to have to see if we end December 31st or we end February 7th.
These are fiscal years.
Okay.
Another tool that financial analysts like to use is what's known as a Monte Carlo simulation. And what a Monte Carlo simulation does in its simplest form is it takes historical returns, it scrambles them up, and then tries to determine what the return of a portfolio would be. And what Jay did is she took very simple portfolio structure of stocks and bonds and at different asset allocation mixes of 70-30, 80-20, and 90-10. And she went back 20 years, and she got the returns off equities or the S&P 500, that was her index, and then the Lehman aggregate, and for her bonds, excuse me. And she scrambled those all up and determined what that return would be. And you can see that on a 70-30 Monte Carlo simulation that she developed a confidence level of close to 95% that we would be able to achieve a return greater than the 5.25%. So there's a risk there, a small risk of 5% that maybe we couldn't achieve that cost of that bond. So again, part of the risk of issuing a POB.
If we stop there just for a minute and back up, I guess we don't have to back the slide up at 18. Fiscal year ending June 30th. Kind of, you made reference to if we would have done this last year, but if we would have done this last year during the legislative session, it would have been very difficult to capture that fiscal year return when we would have taken action on this bill in March or April. And could you kind of elaborate a little bit on that? Because there's a difference between.
I misspoke. If that would have been in June of 06, if we'd done it then, you're right, for the whole year we would have gotten the return of 18.9%. Right. But the cost of doing it would have been June of 06 at 5.75%.
Right. Okay.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, without belaying it, and I know I'd like to emphasize as the sponsor of the bill, the difference between a transaction that we have this high degree of confidence that over the life of the transaction works to our benefit. And that's really what these Monte Carlo simulations are documenting, you know, to the best of the analyst possibilities here. And that's how I bring this proposal forward, with the high confidence in them the transaction working over time. However, if we were to sit here and attempt to pick and say, we're going to do it now because the market's right, to be market timers, the only thing I can be sure about that is that it probably won't work. But again, we are also, as Mr. Anders will point out, a very fortuitous time at the moment with extraordinarily low interest rates and a equity market poised or investment market poised with a lot of potential gains. But I would never suggest that we ever contemplate one of these transactions on the timing of the market at the moment, but it's the underlying science, philosophy, and the demonstrated achievability of results over time that make this a worthwhile risk consideration for the state. Thank you, sir.
General.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a kind of a generic question, and I want to make sure that I fully understand it. And I'm back on this on page 21, the investment return forecast under the different Monte Carlo simulations. And you're assuming a 25-year investment period. And I'm going to assume that that if you're doing it out over 25 years, I'm going to assume that, for example, you recently checked and the cost was 5.25. That's also over the same period of time, right? I mean, that number goes up and down, but it is based upon assumptions in the marketplace at the time over the life of the bonds.
Through the chair, Senator Hill, what a Monte Carlo simulation does is it takes historical returns and then it scrambles them up and says, okay, here's the outcome. And then it goes back and it scrambles them up again over that time period that you've selected, and here's the outcome. And we did, what was it, 10,000 reiterations?
Yes.
Okay, so there was 10,000 of these scrambles, and what did we achieve? And out of that analysis, 95% of the time, we were able to see historically that a portfolio of 70% stocks, 30% bonds would have returned more than the 5.25%.
If I could follow up, I may have asked the question somewhat inarticulately. I mean, I'm assuming that if this bill passes, if somebody makes a decision to go out for $1 billion of POBs, that the interest rate will be predicated over the full life of the term of the bond. Is that?
That's correct. Okay. That's through the chair, Senator Elton. That's the assumption that the 5.25 is a fixed cost for 25 years.
Okay. Thanks.
And could you? So we got two components here. One, we've got a fixed cost component of, in this example, we're using 5.25. And then we've got a Monte Carlo simulation running on the assets that returns that we're going to invest the money in, hypothetically, to hopefully make more than the 5.25 to win the, game. Could you talk a little bit to the committee about when you take that 25-year run to 20, to 15, to 10, and what happens to your probability of outcome on your analysis and take it to 5 as an example or 1. In other words, why didn't you use 1 year versus 25 years?
Through the chair. The reason is the life of the bonds are for 25 years. But in response to your question, the shorter the time period that you have, let's say that we did a 5-year bond, okay? What happens is you have a lot more volatility of returns in those shorter periods. For example, 1 year volatility could be quite huge. It might be as much as a positive 20 to a negative 10. But as you go out in time, that volatility tends to come down into much more manageable numbers. And that return over a longer period of time tends to be, will start averaging out, and it will become more consistent the further out in time as you go. The life of these bonds are for 25 years, so we want to see, you know, how does this portfolio perform over a 25-year period of time. Now, if we shorten the time frame up to 5 or 10 years, you'll see that that confidence level number will go down. It may go down to 70 or 65% or maybe even 50%, where we, over that shorter time period, we won't be able to make that number.
Regresses to the mean.
Exactly.
We have some data in the office on that, Senator Elton. I can share that with you on the Ibbotson Associates data bank, and I would, maybe you can reference where you got your data source on running these. Mm-hmm.
It was ran in-house, and we use a software called Crystal Ball that developed these runs for us. And all we're doing is just taking the numbers off the S&P 500 and the Lehman Index.
So you're using the S&P 500 index?
Yes.
And did you use some kind of, I guess it was at 100% S&P 500, or did you use some allocation within
we
that?
We did the allocations there, Mr. Chairman, the 70-30, the 80-20, and the 90-10.
And the 30 is in the example, 70% in the S&P 500, the 30% is in?
Lehman Aggregate.
Pardon me?
The Lehman Aggregate.
And can you tell us what that is?
That's an index that's used to for fixed income securities.
And it was 10 years? I mean, next 10 years? Or do you know the time frame on that?
The Lehman aggregate duration is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 7 years.
We're going to have him define duration here. We're going to use his lingo so people can follow the conversation. It might be easier to convert that to calendar year time frame, but you can go ahead and tell us what duration is, and then we'll try to keep this in English for the people at home.
Well, rather than, Mr. Chairman, rather than get a long discussion into duration as a measurement, let me just simply say that the Lehman aggregates, the average maturity of the Lehman aggregate or a fixed income portfolio is approximately 10 years.
All right. It's a weighted average of cash flows.
Yep.
Go ahead and continue. And we're going to go up, the bells have rung, but we're going to go up until we either run out of time and then we'll pick this back up or we're finished.
Okay, moving on, I'd just like to say that the unfunded liability, as reported by the state's actuary, was really created not by investment returns, but more from the increased costs, health benefit costs, that we experienced in 2000, 2001, 2003. Also some plan changes that took place in the pension plans. So again, the point is that unfunded liability wasn't really the result of investment returns, but more the cost, the benefit costs that were associated with the plan during that time period. There's political risk associated with POBs, and I touched on this briefly, and that is if you get to an overfunded status of the pension plans, you can there's the potential of handing out more benefits to the participants, which may down the road not the plan may not be able to pay for. There's also market risk, and this is a risk that a lot of people don't talk about too much, but when you issue the POBs, you have proceeds, and in this case, the proceeds are turned over to the retirement system. And how does the ARM board at that time invest those proceeds? Do they simply commingle those with the existing asset allocation or the existing investment plan that's there? Do they invest those proceeds in a more conservative manner, maybe a more aggressive manner? So there's that market risk of not being able to achieve a positive arbitrage in that first couple of years. And again, it's very important. The success of this plan or POBs depend on two things: a low cost and then a positive arbitrage in the first couple of years coming out of the gate.
Can you repeat that again, please? The last part of that?
When the issuance of the bonds has the proceeds, the investments of those proceeds in the first couple of years is very important that we achieve not something less than 5.25. Because what happens, and I'll give you a very simple example, let's say you have $100 and it goes to 50. You've lost $50 or 50% of your money. But to go from 50 back to 100 to get your $50 back, you need 100% gain. So it's important not to go into the hole too much those first couple of years, because then you end up clawing your way out. And you saw that in if we had done this transaction in 2000 and 2001.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, just briefly, one of the strategies that would be recommended by the ARM Board's investment counselors in relating to the investment of the proceeds from a pension obligation bond would likely be a more conservative investment in those early years to make, you know, increase the probability likelihood of obtaining the positive arbitrage. So I wouldn't try to presuppose where the investment counselors would take it, but again, there are definitely courses of action that substantially would mitigate any number of the risks that we're discussing here. We're identifying these risks to show you what they are, but not discussing particularly at length the strategies that could be and would be employed to mitigate those risks, Mr. Chairman.
We have got about 5 to 6 minutes. Maybe the thing to do is we'll just sort of zip through the end of this, because we're going to be bringing this back, and then we'll, next time we come back, we'll go into the cash flow and some of these timing issues?
Yes. Let me just quickly point out that there are three types of debt bonds that a state can issue out there: general obligation, obligations imposed by law, and annual appropriation bonds. POBs that HB 13 calls for are annual appropriation bonds. In other words, it takes an appropriation each year to pay the debt service on these bonds. They're not an obligation on the state. Let me also just go to page 35, which talks about potential savings that POBs can do. And we'll talk here about the PERS. You'll see on this presentation, you'll see two columns and you'll see two matrix in each column. We're going to start in the upper left matrix, and you will see that there's a number up there at 35.22%. That 35.22% is the annual contribution rate that the ARM board adopted for POB, or for the unfunded liability, the contribution rate for the retirement plan. Now, what these matrix do is they'll show you what the potential savings are of issuing a POB or using cash to pay down that unfunded liability. Let me just quickly show that if you do a $2 billion POB transaction, that annual contribution rate falls down from 35% down to 32.9991. And you can see that in that upper row on that first matrix. That's a savings of 2.31% on the annual contribution rate, and that comes off the chart in the lower left column there. Then in the upper right column, we equate that to dollars, and you will see that that's a savings of $38.62 million annually. And then over the life of the bonds, or 25 years, that's a cumulative rate of $544 million of savings, and that's discounted out at 35%.
Okay, Mr. Anders, could we accelerate a little bit, because they're keep ringing the bells at us.
Okay.
And hit, let's take up a taxable issue later. That's pretty straightforward. I don't think we'll have any difficulty understanding that concept here. And well, just go to your takeaways.
Just go to the takeaways. Mr. Chairman, very quickly, if we can earn more than the cost of the POBs, we're better off for issuing it. We are in a very favorable interest rate environment. Let's take advantage of it. Risks associated with POBs are quantifiable and statistically justified by the rewards. And finally, doing nothing is not a viable option. And with that, I'd just also like to say that the administration is in favor of HB 13, and we would like very much to have this tool in our toolbox.
We'll be working on that over the next couple of months and see what we can do. We've been called to the floor, so we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside and bring it back and continue to work on this concept. Our next meeting is Monday at 9 a.m. We're going to have one bill up, Senate Bill 256, a supplemental and capital appropriations. It'll be chaired by Senator Hoffman. And with that, meeting's adjourned. We'll see everybody back at 9 a.m. Monday.